This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number, and our email is talk@talklouisiana.org. And we begin today with an LSU professor, Zebby Goodfriend. His book is Speaking American, Language, Education, and Citizenship in 20th Century Los Angeles, where he spent much time. He got his PhD from the University of California, Los Angeles, in beautiful Westwood, and he has been in Baton Rouge for 6 years.
That's right.
6 years at Louisiana State University, and certainly we have a cosmopolitan university. It was a few years ago named the most diverse in America, but we have a big debate right now over immigration and border security, and you say there's a larger context to this that needs to be examined.
Absolutely. You know, immigration, people are coming from all over the country and from all over the world. And when they come, they are bringing their culture, their language, and they're trying to become a part of America. I think a good place to start is with the story of Otto Preminger. He was a film director, the director of Advise and Consent, nominated for an Academy Award for his directing role. And he was a Jewish emigre from Austria-Hungary. And he was playing a game of cards at the Los Angeles Country Club with some of his fellow emigres. And they were playing cards, and they began speaking in Hungarian. And Otto Preminger stopped the game, and he told his friends, he said, quote, "Wait a minute. This is Los Angeles. This is the United States. We've come here from Europe. We've found physical safety here. This great city has welcomed us. We've found work in the motion picture industries and the universities. And you're sitting there speaking Hungarian? This is Los Angeles. Speak German."
Otto Preminger, by the way, was a mentor to the great Gus Weil, who left Louisiana for a few years to go to New York and work with him. And he did a movie here in Baton Rouge. You probably don't know this, Professor Goodfriend, called Hurry Sundown. Otto Preminger.
I will have to check that out.
But we live in a country now where we celebrate our diversity, kind of. And then some of us don't celebrate it as much as others. We've got a big division in this country, and a lot of it has to do with language, doesn't it?
Absolutely. So there's a constant push for immigrants to come and to learn English. This is one of the major goals of public schools in America. Woodrow Wilson said that public schools were the great melting pot of America and the place where we are made Americans. And so there's an effort by schools to make sure that immigrants are learning English. There's also a great effort by immigrant families that they want to learn English as well. Then the question becomes, what is the role for their native culture? Is that going to be a part of American culture as well? One of the great examples from Los Angeles were the Japanese language schools. The Japanese language schools, they were a community where many of these Japanese were learning English during the day. They spend all day in school, and then in the evening for several hours every night, they also studied Japanese. And there was a pushback in the 1920s, an effort to close these schools. Ultimately, the Supreme Court ruled that, in fact, as private schools, they could operate, they could teach Japanese, but the first principal of a Japanese language school decided that he had to change up his textbooks. He couldn't simply use the textbooks that came from Japan, that came from the emperor. So he took American citizenship textbooks and translated them into Japanese and used that to teach Japanese. In the 1930s, he made an effort that the Japanese students in his school had to stand and honor both the Japanese flag and the American flag when they said the Pledge of Allegiance. So he made a strong effort to become a part of the American community. Of course, on December 7th, 1941, a few hours after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, he was one of the first Japanese Americans arrested by the FBI.
877-217-5757 and talk@talklouisiana.org for Zebby Goodfriend. His name is certainly an ethnic one. The last name is spelled Gutfreund, and I think you've Americanized it just a bit.
Absolutely. In fact, my family is a Jewish family from the area that always alternated back and forth between Russia and Poland. We don't know what our original name was. My grandfather changed it, took on a German name during the war, and he was a refugee when he came. He actually sailed into the port of New Orleans and then took the train straight to San Francisco. He never changed his name back, so we've just gone by good friend, and we say it in English. We say Americanize it.
Well, you were born in San Francisco, raised there, then went to UCLA in Southern California, and now you're in Baton Rouge. A little bit of a difference here, but how would you compare the attitudes about language and about ethnicity in this community as opposed to the way it's viewed in California?
You know, I enjoy teaching classes about immigration at LSU. At UCLA, where the vast majority of students are come from immigrant families, there's not too much room for debate. But when we have debates here, they can be quite lively. And there is a certain question over what it means to be an American, and I really enjoy engaging with students here. You can hear lively defenses of all kinds.
The cultures are different. I've been to the UCLA campus many times, and many Asian students, and it's a much more quiet, sedate campus than as LSU.
That's right. In fact, some people call it the University of Caucasians Lost Among Asians.
You said that.
I did.
And you got your degree from there. And it's a magnificent place, and certainly it is magnificent in large part because of its diversity. But why are we so hung up on trying to keep, quote, our heritage?
That is a great question. Why are we so hung up on trying to keep our heritage? You know, this is a question of what is the American heritage and who are we? Of course, if you go back long enough, nearly all of us are immigrants at some point. Immigrants coming from England, Ireland, and France, even Native Americans coming from all different places. So from my perspective...
And some brought in chains from Africa, of course.
Absolutely. And, of course, in Texas, the textbooks call them migrant workers, which is one way to put it incorrectly. They were slaves brought here against their will.
Right. And right now in Baton Rouge at LSU, we have a state that's one-third African-American almost, but we only have about 10% of the student body that's African-American at LSU. But nonetheless, that's a change from 60 years ago when there were zero black people on campus. And we have a lot of people from the Middle East who study at LSU because of the influence of the petroleum industry in this community. So we have this diverse community that's in our midst. And a listener asks, why is it a necessity for an immigrant, as some are stating, to be able to speak English when they arrive on American soil?
So it's an interesting question. Of course, immigrants, when they come here, they want to be a part of the culture. They want to be active and engaged in American life. And in order to do that, you, for the most part, need to be able to speak English. There's a question of how you can do that. So really, immigrants have viewed language education as an effort and as an expression to become a part of American society, to bring their own culture into American society, and to be active citizens within the United States.
You focus on something in your book, and you refer to it as English-only politics,
mm-hmm.
and it is definitely a part of the culture in California.
Absolutely. In fact, California was one of the first states to pass an English-only amendment in the 1980s. This was an effort that was led by a Japanese-American, by Samuel I. Hayakawa, who was the first Japanese-American senator from California.
U.S. senator.
The U.S. senator from California. And he, on the floor of the Senate, he proposed the English Language Amendment to make English the official language of the United States. California passed that. Dozens of states did, but we still don't have an official language in the United States.
For those who think that race is an issue that is more synonymous in the South than in other places, you know better. In Los Angeles, as you write about it, there have been numerous conflicts involving race, and you mentioned these, what you call L.A. blowouts from 1968 to 1970. What was going on at that time?
Well, in 1968, actually just a few months after Lyndon Johnson signed the Bilingual Education Act, about 10,000 or a few more than 10,000 Mexican-American students walked out of 7 high schools in East Los Angeles. They were demanding changes to the schools. They had a list of 22 demands, and the second demand on their list was for bilingual education. They also wanted to end corporal education. They wanted to change the food in the cafeteria. They wanted to be able to have tacos and wanted to have their mothers come in and share recipes with the cafeteria, but they wanted better schools, and they walked out of school for more than a week.
You note that both conservatives and liberals have tried to control language instruction in Los Angeles in particular. Different points of view, though.
Absolutely, very different points of view. So in the 1920s, Los Angeles introduced an innovation called the Diploma Plan. In the Diploma Plan, what they did was that they made it so that you could be naturalized by taking a citizenship course.
Hold that thought. 877-217-5757. Professor Zevi Goodfriend of LSU is back. His book is Speaking in American, and we return in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. History professor Zevi Goodfriend of LSU is with us. His book is Speaking American. It's about language education and citizenship in Los Angeles in the 20th century, but is applicable to any area of the country and certainly to Louisiana. What are the similarities between our state and your home state of California?
Well, language immersion has become the new buzzword, really, the new approach to to language education. The best way to learn a language is to become fully immersed in it. The first language immersion school was in Los Angeles in 1971 in Culver City, near UCLA. But now it has spread across the country. In 1968, of course, Louisiana introduced CODOFIL, and now there are immersion schools here in Baton Rouge. At Flame, you can be immersed in Spanish or French or Mandarin.
And CODOFIL is still around. And a century ago, it was not uncommon to have families that spoke both French and English in Louisiana. That's not so much the case. And it's kind of a shame that it's going by the wayside.
Absolutely. This is an issue as immigrants become Americanized, as they go on to the second or the third generations, they end up losing their language. In my own family, that's the case. My father, his parents would speak Yiddish to him, but they encouraged him to learn English, and he spoke English back to them. And my wife is the same way. Her mother speaks Cantonese to her, and she responds in English. She understands, but she doesn't speak the same as the previous generation.
Now, I haven't spent as much time in San Francisco as I have in Los Angeles, but for many, there's this perception that there is just this great unification of the masses, people of all types who are getting along well, but I would imagine you have some of the same issues there that we do here.
Absolutely. There's conflict. In fact, when I went to high school in San Francisco, the public school where my father went, it was 50% Jewish when he went there. When I went there, I was the only Jewish student in my class. It was 75% Asian. And in order to meet with the city district's criteria of ethnic diversity, they ended up, there could be no more than 40% of any ethnicity at the magnet school in the city. And the way that they finessed that was they simply divided Asian cultures into each ethnicity. So there was no more than 40% Chinese, but then there were a number of Japanese and Filipinos and all other ethnic groups.
877-217-5757. Mike in New Iberia. Mike, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with Professor Goodfriend.
Yeah, just as an aside, my mother, if she was alive, would be 100 years old, and as a little girl, her grandmother spoke only French. Her mother was conversant, both but preferred French, and Mama told me in elementary school if they spoke French, they'd be punished. So
it was actually discouraged.
Yes, it was. So thank you.
Thank you. Mike in New Iberia.
In fact, there were all kinds of punishments. So in France, you were discouraged from speaking just in the native dialect. You were expected to speak Parisian French. And if you spoke anything else, then you'd be given a brick, and you'd have to hold it out at arm's length until you caught another one of your classmates speaking in the native dialect. And in Los Angeles, they forced the students to draw a circle around themselves and sit there while their classmates got to go to recess if they were speaking Spanish.
Why are we so hung up on our diversity? We celebrate it, as I stated, but at the same time, we always have this tendency, and unfortunately, David Duke, he's wrong about just about everything, but he would say when you go into a cafeteria in Baton Rouge or Los Angeles or San Francisco, you're going to see Asians sitting with Asians, you're going to see black people sitting with black people, and you're going to see whites sitting with whites. And you know, the way he put it, people hang out with their own kind. But there is this tendency to crack the barrier and to be as receptive to people who aren't like us as those who are. Why?
Well, that is a good question. It is something that, so why I study history is because I enjoy finding those who are able to stand out and be different. And probably one of the favorite characters of my book was a man named John Iso, who suffered much discrimination. He was elected the student body president of his middle school in Hollywood, California, in the 1920s. The parents were so upset that the principal ended up canceling student government for the year. In high school, he won the school oratorical contest on the United States Constitution, and he was voted to be the senior class speaker. But when the school sent their representative to compete in the national championship, the school decided that he should declare that he was sick and that his classmate should go. So here's someone who was discriminated against in middle school and high school, but he went on to Harvard Law School and worked in Japan as a lawyer. And when World War II started, despite this discrimination, he volunteered for additional duty in the military, and he was ultimately asked to start the military intelligence school and to train 6,000 other Japanese Americans in Japanese so that they could serve as interrogators and translators for the army. So there was someone who was using his knowledge of another language to promote American citizenship and to overcome the discrimination that he faced.
Zebby Goodfriend, and you're getting in the middle of a debate that has great sensitivity. I'm sure you're aware of this.
Absolutely, and the debate continues today. In fact, in January at Duke Medical School, the graduate advisor had to step down because she wrote an email to the graduate students saying that asking the foreign students, the Chinese students, to stop speaking Chinese in the hallway. That this was a complaint, and she ended up having to step down. There is still debates, even in our universities today, some of our finest universities, discomfort over speaking other languages.
Where do you think the debate is going?
Well, the debate is going in a lot of different directions. It's going to the border. In fact, President Trump's speechwriter, Stephen Miller, went to the White House press conference room and said that the Statue of Liberty had nothing to do with immigration, and that he proposed that all immigrants who come here should demonstrate knowledge of English. Later, genealogists found that, in fact, when Stephen Miller's great-grandmother came here in 1906, she didn't speak English. And ultimately, his great-grandfather had failed his citizenship test in 1932.
Mm-hmm. In this chain immigration that President Trump has denounced, his father-in-law and mother-in-law were beneficiaries of this, weren't they?
Absolutely. And, of course, he's married to an immigrant.
Of course, and it was married to an immigrant previously.
That's right.
And to put a little levity to this, it makes him an expert on foreign affairs. Zebby Goodfriend, you're also involved with Go Teach. What's Go Teach?
Go Teach is a program for students in every discipline to major and graduate in 4 years, and when they graduate, they will have finished their student teaching, and they will be certified to teach in Louisiana schools. They can teach in secondary schools. I'm in charge of the history program, but we have it in English, foreign languages, the sciences, and the math. And the Go Teach History program was designed and created by a colleague of yours, or friend of yours, Carl Reuter. Great man.
Great man, and went to Stanford University and came back.
He sure did, and he stayed at LSU for 46 years.
You think you'll be there 46 years?
Well, I've only got 40 more to go.
But it is amazing. We often talk about LSU having challenges, and they continuously have challenges with the budget, and there's this brain drain that's discussed, but there is something Hugh Buckingham called the brain remain. Most people stay. For whatever reason, there's this pull, and they come from all over the country, in some cases all over the world, but usually they stay.
You know, and when I work with the Go Teach students, I don't just see students for a semester. I'm with them for four semesters. I see them through their student teaching, and really the great reward of being here is getting to work with the students at LSU.
And some of the issues that are in Speaking American will certainly be on vivid display in next year's election. I have a feeling this could be an election even more contentious than the last.
It's already starting. It will be a very interesting process.
Well, Zebby Goodfriend, congratulations on your book. Again, it's Speaking American, Language Education and Citizenship in 20th Century Los Angeles, and it applies to people all over the United States and certainly in our great land of Louisiana. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Jim.
877-217-5757 is your number. This is Talk Louisiana on WRKF, and now we part briefly for the news with the impeccable Karen Henderson. Andrew Finn McGill. He grew up immersed in music. He lives in Asheville, North Carolina, and he will be in Baton Rouge tomorrow night at Highland Coffees. He's been there once before, and Highland Coffees, in addition to being a hangout for a lot of people at Louisiana State University and beyond, has become an oasis for music on occasion. This gentleman at age 16 was a two-time finalist at the All-Ireland Championships. He's equally proficient in several American folk idioms, such as old time and bluegrass. And he is with us telephonically, getting ready to board a plane for Baton Rouge, I'm sure. And good to hear your voice again, Andrew Finn McGill.
Hey, great to be here, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Well, you certainly have a following. And you have an ability that has been appreciated in many parts of this country and elsewhere. And Highland Coffees is a distinct venue, and you're coming back for an encore, so you must have liked the first visit.
We like the coffee, too, I think, yeah. It's great.
Well, tomorrow night, this gentleman, all of 32 years old, composer and musician of significance, will be in Highland Coffees, and you will be playing what kind of music?
We'll be playing traditional Irish music. This is actually the kind of music I grew up playing. My parents are traditional Irish musicians, and I'll have Alan Murray with me, who's a fantastic guitarist and singer from Glasgow, Scotland, and this will kind of kick off a 10-day St. Patrick's tour.
This is appropriate. St. Patrick's Day, of course, is a big event in Baton Rouge with this spectacular parade that will be Saturday the 16th. It started many years ago with Pat Shingleton with just a few floats, and now it's taken a life of its own. And let us not forget that the 17th, the actual St. Patrick's Day, is the 40th birthday of the most famous Baton Rougean, Stormy Daniels. So we certainly will be celebrating St. Patty's Day in Baton Rouge. And you grew up in Asheville. Your father certainly had a musical influence. I'm sure he was a big influence on you.
Absolutely. Well, he, apart from being a musician, he's also the founder and director of something called the Swannanoa Gathering, which is a series of essentially fiddle camps. It's a five-week long event, but organized in different weeks by genre and instrument. So there's a fiddle week, there's a banjo mandolin week. And I essentially grew up there taking classes from all of these amazing musicians in Irish music and bluegrass and old time, various things like that. So that's going on. I mean, that's been going on for almost 30 years, so pretty much my life.
And you also were awarded a Fulbright Fellowship for your work. That must have been quite an honor and an experience.
Yeah, that was an amazing experience. That was in Malawi. which is in the southeastern part of Africa, in 2009-10. And he was actually a Fulbright in public health, but sort of the Capstone Project was a concept album about HIV/AIDS, which was the public health element to the project. But it's a project I did with an amazing musician from Malawi, a guy named Peter Mwanga, who is really an amazing musician and also like a really big social activist. So it just made sense to merge these two worlds.
You have performed all over the world, and people who have, like you, often say that some of these places off the beaten path, like Highland Coffees, are often the best venues for your work.
I'm sorry.
Often these places are like hidden nuggets. You have an audience that's certainly very receptive to what you do.
Absolutely. You know, right now I can't even remember how this all happened, how we first got to Highland Coffees. I think it was like a friend of a friend of a friend that recommended them to us. And we never expected to have such the reception that we did. I mean, it's a coffee shop. You think, you know, there's going to be a lot of hustle and bustle, and we had an enraptured audience. It was amazing. And so Clark, the owner, was like, you guys got to come back. And so hence, you know, tomorrow.
It's Andrew Finn McGill, who plays a lot. You play in a lot of places, don't you?
I suppose I do, yeah. I'm not a very sedentary person. I like to be on the road.
And you've got some exceptional reaction from people who know your kind of music. Liz Carroll, for example, says the tunes Finn's written are melodic and heartfelt. The arrangements are gorgeous. Every note, chord, and beat captivates and delights. There's a globe of influence whittled down here to one fiddler's vision, and the result is a wonderful perfection. Now, you are not only a musician, you're a writer, and sometimes those two go hand in glove. Other times people have skills in one and not the other. How long have you been doing both?
That's a good question. I mean, probably since I was a kid. You know, my dad is something of a Renaissance man, you could say. I mean, he does woodworking, he paints, he writes music, he writes poetry. So I think, you know, whenever I saw that as a kid, kids always want to emulate the parents. So, you know, I would buy my colored pencils and my manuscripts to write tunes with and fiddle lessons, you know. So ever since I was a kid, I've always been kind of surrounded by different kinds of artists and, you know, wanted to experiment with lots of different things.
Well, we wish you well and look forward to seeing you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, Highland Coffees. It'll be Andrew Finn McGill. Thank you, Andrew, and good luck.
Thank you, Jim.
See you soon.
Thank you.
Take care. And today, by the way, is also the 80th birthday of a musician and songwriter of renown, Neil Sedaka, born on this date in 1939 in Brooklyn. A long, long career. He had ups and downs. He was around in the 50s and had a downturn, came back big in the 70s. Laughter in the Rain is perhaps his best-known song, 1974. But a few years ago, we had Toni Tennille on this show from The Captain and Tennille. And she talked about how his big comeback began with her recording, Love Will Keep Us Together, a number one song from Captain and Tennille. And right at the end of the song, in tribute to Neil Sedaka, do we have it, Matt Doyle? She kind of slid in this little salute to Neil Sedaka. Listen closely. Did you hear that? Sedaka is back. It's kind of clever. And the Captain and Tennille went on to have almost as big a career as Neil Sedaka. But he was born on this date, March 13th, 1939, Brooklyn. Same place that gave us Barbara Streisand and Neil Diamond. Graduate of Abraham Lincoln High School in Brooklyn and the Juilliard School. And he has had a long, long career. Age 80 years old today is Neil Sedaka. Over the last few days, we lost one of the giants in our community. He was a guest on this show not so long ago for reasons that most people probably were unaware of his past. Paul Marks, the fine attorney Born June 20, 1942, he died March 8. He was 76 years old, and I saw him just a few days ago, actually, at Julio's, and he looked in fine form, but he died at the age of 76. His services today, 1 p.m., B'nai Israel visitation, 11 to 1. His son, Sonny, has been a sports writer and wrote a fine book about the 1978 LSU basketball game that changed the nature of LSU basketball forever when Dale Brown's team beat Kentucky in overtime, 95-94, February 11, 1978. All five starters fouled out, and LSU prevailed against the Wildcat team of Joe B. Hall that won the national title at the Assembly Center. The fans stormed the court, and the book is called Five, and Paul was very proud of Sonny for good reason. And Paul marks, when he was a much younger man and a student at LSU, he was the keeper of Mike the Tiger. And in those days, as we know, Mike came to every game, every football game, and terrorized the opposition. They had him parked outside the locker room, roaring as the opposing team ran on the field. That had to be worth at least a field goal. And sometimes, as you know, field goals make a difference in football games. And it's kind of a shame that the current Mike doesn't go to the games. But Paul said that they used to get the Tiger ready by not feeding him. And so they would lure him into the cage with food. But as we know, a few times over the years, the Tiger was actually kidnapped, mostly by Tulanians who were up to no good. In 1981, they kidnapped Mike, and he was found on Nicholson Drive. They had to knock him out with tranquilizers, and then after that happened, Mike the Tiger had to be picked up by 13 men and hauled back to his cage. He's a big tiger, you know, 500 and some odd pounds. And dead weight, it wasn't an easy task getting Mike back, but fortunately he did not hurt anybody. A few years later, Dale Brown had befriended this gentleman from Brazil, and he came to the United States, and he was hoping to get a job, and things were not working out so well, and he was hoping that Dale Brown would come to his rescue, so he got in the cage with the tiger. Dale Brown was in Florida at a speaking engagement in Gainesville, if I remember, and he gets a call saying this guy you know named Gatto is in the cage with the tiger. And this was before cell phones, and Dale got on the first trip back and first plane back, and they finally coaxed this guy out of the cage, and fortunately he was not hurt. But Paul Marks, back in the day, he told the story that there was word that the Ole Miss students were going to kidnap Mike. So he drove Mike the Tiger to his family home on Raymond Drive, Raymond Avenue, and Mike the Tiger spent the night in his garage. And he came to Tiger Stadium the next day and terrorized the Ole Miss team, and the Tigers defeated the Johnny Rebs from Oxford, Mississippi. But Paul Marks was quite a man and a great friend, 76 years old, and we will miss him, and he is a guy who knows this community well. He knew it well. He went to Highland Elementary School, rode horses as a boy, stabling it as what is now Acadian Thruway. And we'll return with more Talk Louisiana after this brief timeout. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Matt Doyle producing, and your number is 877-217-5757. We're joined by Pulitzer Prize winner Matt Richtel, New York Times reporter. He works for the Times, but he's based in San Francisco. His book is An Elegant Defense, The Extraordinary New Science of the Immune System. And good morning to you, Matt.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. And this is a big topic, certainly an important topic. And you say today more than ever, medicine is being refined through the lens of the immune system. What is going on with this?
Yeah. So, man, did I discover a lot over the last 3 years, but one of the chief thing I discovered is there's this network going on below our consciousness that is just defending us, acting as spy, acting as surveyor of the landscape, and it is defining how we are healthy, how long we live, and our relationship not just with disease, but lots of healthy, lots of other microbes and bacteria and virus around us. It is the lens through which medicine is being seen now, our immune system.
And this was inspired by a friend of yours, Jason Greenstein, who had an amazing turnabout, and you, of course, attribute this to the immune system. What happened with Jason?
Yeah, so this is a story I think anybody who's got cancer or knows someone with cancer could relate to. I had a buddy who was Mr. Everything in high school, all-state baseball, all-state basketball, the whole thing. But when we got to be many years later, he got cancer. And he, the chemo and radiation, Jim, didn't save him. He had 15 pounds of cancer doubling every few weeks in his back. His doctor told him tearfully, "Jason, I love you, man, but it's time to go home and die." And then, with all this in hospice, he took this last-minute immunotherapy drug, and a couple weeks later, his girlfriend woke him up and said, "Jason, get out of bed, my friend. Your tumors have disappeared." And he rose like Lazarus. And I decided to pick up my pen and learn not just what is immunotherapy, but what is the immune system? And that's what led to this book.
Well, you have many people who are certainly no quacks. Nobel Prize-winning immunologist James Allison, who's involved in this. But when people hear things like this, I think of like Steve McQueen, who went to Mexico and didn't work out very well. But
yeah,
you're saying that, of course, that was 1980. This is 39 years later. There are some amazing things going on, aren't there?
Yeah. So this is I'm glad you brought that up. You know, we've had all these dreams of could we get at all these diseases? And to go back to your first question, what's happening now is that we have learned to tinker with the immune system on the molecular level. So this book isn't a cancer book, even though Jason is one of the stories. In it are people with autoimmunity, people with HIV, and we are two women with autoimmunity, and they're very important in this conversation because we are learning to tinker with the immune system so that we can put on the brakes or accelerate the immune system to attack diseases we couldn't attack before. And just to go at that, Steve, can I just pile onto that Steve McQueen great observation
certainly.
For 1 second? This is the difference about the past and where we are now. We used to try to attack the disease. So with cancer, we would attack the tumor, and that meant chemotherapy and wiping our bodies out. But now we're trying to use our immune system and tinker with it, tinker with the tool rather than the invader. And that is letting us be more precise. Now, to be really fair, we haven't figured it all out yet by any stretch. But what this book attempts to do is give people the science behind all these remarkable innovations happening, partly so they can make good decisions about how they want to treat themselves.
We're listening to Matt Richtel. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter based in San Francisco, and his book is An Elegant Defense, The Extraordinary New Science of the Immune System. And this not only applies to cancer, it applies to these autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis and lupus. You say that this is applicable to them as well.
Yeah, so here's what's happening in the immune system, and I really feel for the sufferers of these diseases who were disproportionately women for reasons I can get into if you want, but they were often invisible, Jim. I mean, you know, there was no bug or germ or pathogen to find. There was no bacteria or virus attacking them. It's their own body attacking them. And I'm sure you've heard these stories from friends, or maybe you know somebody. You know, I feel fatigue, my stomach, my joints hurt, I have low-grade fever. They are not making this up. What is happening under those circumstances is that their body is attacking themselves, so it appears invisible and that there's no invader. And for years people were told it's in your head and so forth. Now what we're doing with the current medicines is we're finding ways to put brakes on the immune system, to tinker at the molecular level so that it stops its attack. It's so profound, it's almost hard to express.
You say that stress is a killer. It's terrible for our immune system. Why is it something that knocks our immune system out of whack?
so significant, Jim, how quickly it can work. So stress is essential for our survival. And if I could take us back in time for a second, you're being chased by a lion. Your fight or flight mechanisms come in. And what happens is your body diverts resources from, say, dealing with a chronic threat like a head cold or the flu or whatever, to just surviving in the moment. In order to divert the resources, a whole bunch of hormones get sent forth, maybe ones people have heard of, cortisol, which is a steroid, epinephrine, norepinephrine. But what these have the effect of doing, Jim, is suppressing the immune system. Now, you might say, why in the heck would it do that? But the reason is that it's trying to put the resources toward the immediate threat, which weighs a ton, or whatever a lion weighs. What's, Jim, what's a lion weigh?
About 500 pounds.
500 pounds. And I can tell you what it weighs in San Francisco, but not in the Eastern time zone. It weighs 500 pounds minus 3 hours, and it's attacking you. So your body isn't really worried about whether you have a head cold. Well, what's happened today, and it's really significant, is that we are not facing, at least in our blessed worlds we have right now, we're not being chased by lions. We are facing threats, but sometimes our bodies don't understand the distinction between a real life-threatening event and the fight-or-flight experiences we imagine we're having. So, you know, my wife gets mad at me for, taking out the garbage, or my boss gets mad at me or whatever. It's not a lion. There is no lion. But it sets off a similar cascade that can have a powerful, powerful impact on the immune system. Can I give you one example about herpes?
Sure.
So herpes is a virus. The Epstein-Barr virus is one of the most commonly held. Terrific research was done on West Point cadets, on medical students, and here's what herpes does. You know, you get cold sores on your mouth. Well, herpes hangs out in the ganglia, in basically around the base of your brain, and the healthy immune system keeps it in check. But when you get stressed, your immune system gets diverted or gets weakened, and it basically crawls down. And everybody knows the experience, or many people know the experience, of they get a little stressed or a little sleepless, and they get a cold sore. That is a weakened immune system, unable then to hold the herpes in check.
All right. A listener wanted me to follow up on your assessment that I've heard before, that more women, by a large margin, are affected by these autoimmune conditions than men. Why?
Yeah, so great question. I address this in the book. There are some hypotheses that are not fully proven, but I'll give you some of them. What the people who study this say is, first of all, women confer immunity to babies. So through breast milk, through in the gestation period, so they have a stronger immune system to begin with. It appears that more of the genetic material associated with an immune system are on the X chromosomes. And finally, women might have more fat cells, which means more immune cells. What does it add up to? Women live longer, but it comes at the cost of having women have a stronger immune system, which comes at the which gives the benefit of living longer, but also may bring this stronger immune system. I want to come to a punchline, one of the punchlines of this book. There are many, but this is one big one, Jim, if I might. You want to be careful about boosting your immune system. It's something marketers tell us all the time. I will tell you from my research that over and over, the world's leading immunologists would say, you don't want to boost your immune system. You want to support your immune system doing what it does. But an out-of-control immune system is as dangerous as any invader your body can face.
The book is An Elegant Defense, a story of both the immune system's mechanics and its reach into the practical side of health. And Matt Richtel is a versatile man. His Pulitzer was on a series about distracted driving, and you have been back in a big way. And I think this book appropriately was inspired by some people very close to you.
Yeah. I mean, in the end, a lot of what the immune – well, I felt a little emotional when you said that because I'm always driven in the end by story and connection. And
okay, we do have to roll, but thank you, Matt Richtel. Congratulations on your book. Stay tuned.